Network. This is Democracy Now!
Our country is going hungry. On the week before Thanksgiving, and the Senate broke. I don't care what party you are. It is an abandonment of our responsibilities.
With some 54 million Americans going hungry, food lines stretching for miles are seen across the country. We'll speak to Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. Then, a betting pool? That's what managers at a Tyson pork slaughterhouse set up to bet on how many workers would get COVID. Six workers died at the Iowa plant. More than 1,000 were infected. Finally, 2020 has become the deadliest year on record for transgender and gender nonconforming people. We'll speak to Tory Cooper of Human Rights Campaign.
Has made it just an incredibly toxic soup of violence and all of these different things that make trans lives seem devalued.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's cleared the way for President-elect Joe Biden's transition after 16 days of delay that threatened to derail the incoming administration's preparations for reviving the economy and battling the coronavirus pandemic. Emily Murphy, the Trump-appointed head of the General Services Administration, had refused to declare Joe Biden the apparent victor of the November 3rd election, despite overwhelming evidence. Murphy finally made that determination Monday as House Democrats demanded she appear on Capitol Hill and as President Trump tweeted his support for her. Trump did not concede his election loss, but tweeted he would allow the transition to begin, quote, in the best interest of our country. The move will free up more than $7 million in funding for Biden's transition team, which will now receive office space and government briefings. On Monday, Michigan's Board of State canvassers certified Joe Biden's win by a margin of more than 154,000 votes. Also Monday, more than 160 corporate CEOs wrote to Trump urging he begin the transition. The letter was organized in part by the New York State Attorney General Letitia James, who wrote in a separate statement, quote, without the rule of law and an orderly transfer of power, everything from commerce to health care delivery to national security is in peril, and our business leaders can see that as clearly as the rest of us, she said. President-elect Biden's cabinet is beginning to take more shape. Former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen is expected to be nominated as Treasury Secretary. She would become the first woman to hold the post, as will Avril Haines, Biden's pick to be the Director of National Intelligence. Haines is a former deputy director of the CIA who played a key role in Obama's drone wars. She's also been criticized for her role absolving the CIA officers who hacked into Senate Intelligence Committee computers in an attempt to thwart and undermine the Senate's torture probe. Biden has named Alejandro Mayorkas, a Cuban immigrant, to head the Department of Homeland Security. He'll become the first Latinx and first immigrant to hold the post. While working in the Obama administration, Mayorkas helped develop and implement the DACA program. That's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Biden has also named former Secretary of State John Kerry to be a special envoy on climate, a newly formed position. Kerry helped negotiate the Paris Climate Accord. He will sit on the National Security Council. Meanwhile, Biden's facing pressure from progressives not to select former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel to a cabinet post. On Monday, New York Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, quote, Rahm Emanuel helped cover up the murder of Laquan McDonald. Covering up a murder is disqualifying for public leadership. It's shameful and concerning he's even being considered, she said. The United States recorded nearly 180,000 new coronavirus infections Monday and over 1,000 deaths, with 45 states reporting an increase in week-over-week cases. The U.S. broke its record for hospitalizations for the 14th consecutive day, with nearly 86,000 COVID-19 patients hospitalized coast to coast. Medical workers around the U.S. are growing increasingly exhausted as hospitals fill to capacity and supplies of personal protective equipment run dry. Gene Ross, president of National Nurses United, spoke in a conference call Monday.
Nearly 1 year into this pandemic, our hospitals are knowingly still not prepared. Our latest survey of nurses showed that more than 80% of hospitals have done no surge capacity planning. And the Trump administration has explicitly stated it is not even trying to contain the virus.
To see our full interview with Gene Ross, you can go to democracynow.org. Hospitals are warning of an even more dire situation ahead, with millions of Americans ignoring the Centers for Disease Control's recommendation against traveling for Thanksgiving. On Monday, the Transportation Security Administration said over 3 million people traveled by air over the weekend, the busiest three-day period since last March. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom and his family have gone into quarantine after his children were exposed to a member of the Highway Patrol who contracted the coronavirus. Governor Newsom also apologized Monday after photos emerged of him flouting his own coronavirus guidelines while attending a dinner party at an exclusive French restaurant in Napa November 6. Newsom was photographed wearing no mask and seated in a tight cluster of people that included the chief executive of the California Medical Association and the group's top lobbyist.
I made a mistake being with a few extra people beyond the guidelines that I've been promoting, which is outside the households. That was a mistake. And I let my guard down and I apologize for it.
Meanwhile, the number of COVID-19 cases among members of President Trump's inner circle continues to rise. Donald Trump Jr. announced Friday he tested positive for coronavirus the previous Monday. Don Jr. was among some 250 people who packed the East Room of the White House on election night, almost none of them wearing masks. Ben Carson, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, said Friday he'd been desperately ill with COVID-19 but was recovering. Dr. Carson said his condition improved at Walter Reed Medical Center after President Trump intervened on his behalf. Carson wrote on Facebook, quote, President Trump was following my condition and cleared me for the monoclonal antibody therapy that he had previously received, which I'm convinced saved my life. Dr. Carson is just one of a handful of people able to access Regeneron's therapeutic before the FDA granted the drug emergency use authorization last Saturday. The treatment continues to remain in short supply, with Regeneron saying it will ship doses for 80,000 patients by the end of November. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong and two fellow campaigners face up to 3 years in prison after pleading guilty to charges related to inciting and organizing a massive protest last year against a proposed extradition bill with China. Opposition to the bill triggered months of ongoing protests across Hong Kong. This is Joshua Wong speaking to the press Monday.
I'm persuaded neither prison bars, nor election bans, nor any other arbitrary power will stop us from activism. What we are doing now is to explain the value of freedom to the world.
In Somalia, at least 4 people are dead after tropical cyclone Gati made landfall Sunday. The storm was poised to drop 2 years' worth of rain in 2 days. It's the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the northern Indian Ocean and to hit Somalia. It rapidly intensified as it approached eastern Africa. This comes as scientists say this is happening more frequently as storms are given a boost by the rising ocean temperatures fueled by the climate crisis. New details have emerged about why U.S. prosecutors dropped narco-trafficking and money laundering charges against Mexico's former defense minister, Salvador Cienfuegos. Reuters reports Attorney General William Barr agreed to drop the charges after Mexican officials privately promised him they would arrest a senior cartel leader involved with trafficking large quantities of the synthetic opioid fentanyl. The Drug Enforcement Administration had accused General Cienfuegos of protecting the violent H2 drug cartel while directing Mexico's army against its rivals. Authorities in Florida have opened an investigation into the recent police killing of two black teenagers who were shot at least eight times while driving a car in Cocoa, Florida, at around 10:30 a.m. November 13th. One passenger in the car survived. Attorney Benjamin Crump is now representing the families of 16-year-old Angelo Crooms and 18-year-old Sincere Pierce. Crump said the teenagers were terrified and tried to drive around the officers who were aiming guns at the car. The officers were following the car because they thought it had been stolen. But in fact, the car belonged to the girlfriend of one of the teenagers. In Omaha, Nebraska, protests continue over the weekend after two Omaha police officers shot dead Kenneth Jones, a 35-year-old black man, during a routine traffic stop Thursday. Police smashed in the passenger window where Jones was sitting and attempted to drag him out of the car before opening fire. According to a police press release, the officers continued to yell at Jones to show his hands even after they had shot him. In California, San Francisco District Attorney Jason Boudin has filed homicide charges against a police officer who shot dead an unarmed black man in 2017. The officer, Christopher Samayoa, shot Keita O'Neill from inside his patrol car after a chase. Boudin is believed to be the first San Francisco District Attorney to ever file homicide charges against an officer. In Kentucky, a leader of the movement demanding justice for Breonna Taylor has been fatally shot. 21-year-old Hamza Travis Nagdi was reportedly struck by multiple bullets during a suspected carjacking early Monday near the University of Louisville campus. Police have released few details and have not named a suspect. Nagdi was well known for leading chants over his bullhorn at Black Lives Matter events, demanding the officers who shot and killed Breonna Taylor in her own home last March be charged with murder. He voted for the first time just 3 weeks ago in the November 3rd election. In Tacoma, Washington, the immigrant rights group La Resistencia is reporting at least seven prisoners at Northwest Detention Center have gone on hunger strike following the alleged assault earlier this week of a 19-year-old prisoner when a guard reportedly put their knee on the teen's neck. At least four others were placed in solitary confinement in retaliation for speaking up against the attack, according to the group, including a 62-year-old prisoner who has cancer and other serious health problems. This comes as prisoners continue to fight for their release during the pandemic. This is Gabby Pada Perez, one of the hunger strikers, speaking from Northwest Detention Center, where she's been imprisoned for nearly a year.
I want to be released to be able to deal with this with my family. At 26 years old, I should not be having high cholesterol. I should not be having half of these medical issues that I have only because I have been in here. It is not mandatory for us to be in here. Half of the people that are still here don't have a single thing on their criminal record. Others, they've lived in the United States for more than 25 years. And so I know that that it's not independently of what a judge has said. ICE has a decision to let us all go.
In more immigration news, the New York radio station WNYC reports nine immigrants being held at the Bergen County Jail in New Jersey have been on hunger strike for nearly 2 weeks. The prisoners are demanding their release amidst growing concerns over the spread of COVID-19 in the crowded and squalid jail. Several of them have health problems, including kidney disease, making them more vulnerable to worsening COVID symptoms. General Motors is recalling some 7 million pickup trucks and SUVs worldwide to replace potentially dangerous airbags. This comes after the U.S. government ordered GM to recall the vehicles, which GM maintains are safe to drive. Meanwhile, the automaker's withdrawn support for the Trump administration's years-long efforts to block California from establishing its own fuel efficiency standards. The New York Times reports GM's move signals the company is ready to work with President-elect Joe Biden in reducing climate warming emissions from cars and trucks. In Puerto Rico, the beloved social leader Carlos Taza Zenon died at the age of 84 last Friday. He was a longtime activist who for decades led the fight against the U.S. Navy's occupation of the island of Vieques, his hometown, where the U.S. government tested weapons and held military training exercises. Between 1978 and 83, Zenon and other fishermen repeatedly confronted U.S. Navy ships and halted planned military exercises. The Navy finally left Vieques in 2003 after bombing it with napalm for years. And former New York City Mayor David Dinkins has died at the age of 93. Dinkins was elected New York's 106th mayor in 1989, defeating Republican challenger Rudy Giuliani to become the only African-American ever to hold the position. During his 4 years in office, Dinkins expanded the size of New York's police force to record levels. He also backed the movement against apartheid in South Africa, ordering the city to divest its pension fund from companies doing business there. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. In New Jersey, as in so many other places around the country, COVID is exponentially spreading. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, before we move on with our first story, I just wanted to get comment from you on the last two obits we brought people in the headlines. I want to start with Mayor David Dinkins, a Howard graduate who became the first and only African-American mayor of New York.
Yes, Amy. Well, as you know, I knew David Dinkins pretty well over the years, covered him during before his administration and then afterward as well. What you could say about David Dinkins is he practiced an old style of politics in New York City, the politics of civility, which is rare in many political leaders. He was, of course, the first African-American mayor in the 80s, where all the big cities of America suddenly had African-American mayors. Tom Bradley in Los Angeles, Harold Washington in Chicago, Wilson Good in Philadelphia. And Dinkins was the last of this group to come to office. He only served one term. Most people forget that he was a Democratic Socialist before Democratic Socialism was in vogue. He was a member of Democratic Socialists of America, and he had a liberal brand of politics. But what a lot of people don't realize also about David Dinkins is that he was a reluctant mayor. He never really wanted to be mayor of New York City, but he was thrust into that position by the Rainbow Coalition movement of the day. Jesse Jackson in 1988 had really won New York City through his Rainbow Coalition in his second quest for president. And it was that coalition that sort of propelled Dinkins into office. I'll never forget New Year's Day of 1989. I flew to Puerto Rico to cover the inauguration of a new governor in Puerto Rico. And Dinkins and several other politicians were on the plane, the same plane that day. He was the Manhattan Borough president at the time. And at one point, he comes up to me in the back of the plane because he was up there in first class. I'm down in coach. And he sits next to me and he says, well, you know, they want me to run for mayor. And I'm not sure if I want to do this because I'd have to give up my seat as Manhattan Borough president. And this is the job I always wanted, Manhattan Borough president. And he says to me, what do you think I should do? And I said, Mr. Dinkins, I'm not, I'm a journalist. I'm not involved in politics. But one thing I've learned is if you're going to accomplish any great thing in life, you have to be willing to sacrifice a lot. And so that's the only advice I can give you. And about 3 weeks later, he decided he was going to throw his hat in, and he won, but he only served one term. And I think the problem with David Dinkins is he did a lot of good. And I think the most you mentioned the battle against apartheid. People forget he brought Nelson Mandela to New York City right after Mandela had been freed, gave him a ticker tape parade, and really associated New York with supporting the battle to end minority rule in South Africa. But he was felled in large part by the Crown Heights riot, by the surge in crime and the crack cocaine epidemic, and by the refusal of the police department really to work for him. And they did everything possible to undermine him. And as a result, he only served one term with Rudy Giuliani coming in as mayor. And of course, we all know who Rudy Giuliani is now. But back then, a lot of people considered Giuliani almost a mythic figure in big city politics. And we've now seen toward the end of Giuliani's career what he's really like. So David Dinkins was a refreshing figure in New York City politics.
And in that battle against apartheid, he took on the nation's banks, fighting to have the city divest of its like $500 million worth of pension fund stock invested in companies that did business in South Africa, and passed a bill that allowed the city to rate banks on their opposition to apartheid.
Yes, yes, and New York's decision to divest was a big blow, and really, I think, really propelled the divestment movement and really forced corporate America, in large extent, to turn more and more against the South African government.
And finally, another obit today. In Puerto Rico, the beloved social leader Carlos Tazes Anand died at the age of 84 last Friday. The longtime activist who, among many other actions, fought against the U.S. Navy's occupation and constant bombing of the island of Vieques. The significance of Anand, Juan.
Yes, well, Zenón was another major figure in the Puerto Rican community, not only in Puerto Rico, but in the United States. I met him for the first time in 1979 in Philadelphia, because it turns out many of the Viequense fishermen who had been dislocated from their lands ended up migrating to the United States, primarily in Philadelphia. So there was a large community of Puerto Ricans from Vieques in the Philadelphia Camden area. And Zenón would go back there often to raise funds and support for the efforts of the fishermen to block the Navy blockades. They actually interrupted over 30, 35 naval exercises with their boats repeatedly from 1978 through 1983. And this was way before Vieques was known as an international symbol of a battle against colonialism. So Zenón really was a mythic figure. And later on, years later, his sons and other members of his family would continue the fight, which eventually ended in forcing the U.S. Navy out of Vieques in the early 2000s. So this was a battle that went on for 25, 30 years, and Zenón was a person who touched it off back in the late 1970s.
And for people who aren't familiar with what the military did for decades, they bombed Vieques with napalm, with depleted uranium, and many other toxic explosives. Well, Juan, thanks so much for explaining the significance of both losses today, as we remember not only Zenón, but the first African-American mayor of New York, David Dinkins. When we come back, with some 54 million Americans going hungry, the food lines, people in lines, cars in lines for miles are seen across this country. Stay with us.
Can I kick it? Yes, you can. Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
Well, I'm born.
Born,
can I kick it? To my tribe that flows in layers. Right now, Fife is a point sayer. At times, I'm a studio conveyor. Mr. Dinkins, would you please be my mayor? You'll be doing us a really big favor. Boy, this track really has a lot of flavor. When it comes to rhythms, Quest is your savior. Follow us for the funky behavior. Make a note on the rhythm we gave you. Feel free, drop your pants, yeah, yeah, hey, yeah. Do you like the garments that we wear? I instruct you to be the obeyer. A rhythm recipe that you'll savor. Doesn't matter if you're minor or major. Yes, the tribe of the game with a player. As you inhale like a breath of fresh air.
Can I kick it? By A Tribe Called Quest. The song includes a famous shout out to vote for David Dinkins, who died last night at his home in New York, about a month after his wife, Joyce Dinkins, died. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, as we look now at the growing number of people in the United States who do not have enough food to eat. thousands upon thousands are standing in lines in food pantries and parked in hours-long, miles-long lines of cars at food banks across the country. A recent poll found 4 in 10 Americans say they've experienced food insecurity for the first time during the COVID-19 pandemic. Here in New York, some food banks had to turn away families amidst unprecedented demand. This is Harlem resident Ruth Crawford in line at a food bank that handed out 500 turkeys to residents, including herself.
You have to try to relax and think of the better things, because it wasn't always like this. But this is getting to people, and it's just sad. I mean, you work all the time, and you can't go to work, or you can't work from home, so it's not easy.
The Hunger Relief Group Feeding America warns some 54 million U.S. residents currently face food insecurity amidst a massive public health and economic crisis. Two recent surveys found almost 10% of parents with children under the age of 5 cannot afford enough food for their kids. Many say they've struggled even more after the expiration of federal assistance programs in the CARES Act. And Senate Republicans in the White House have refused to advance multiple relief measures passed by the Democrat-controlled House. This is Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking Friday on the House floor after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sent the Senate home for Thanksgiving without finalizing a coronavirus relief bill.
Our country is going hungry on the week before Thanksgiving, and the Senate broke. I don't care what party you are. It is an abandonment of our responsibilities as elected officials who are charged with acting in the public trust.
This comes as the United Nations World Food Program predicts acute hunger could affect 270 million people worldwide by the end of 2020. An 82% increase since the start of the pandemic. Amidst the economic fallout from pandemic-related layoffs and less money being sent home by relatives working in wealthier countries like the United States. For more, we're joined by Raj Patel, award-winning author, filmmaker, co-host of the food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. He teaches at the University of Texas, Austin, is currently completing a documentary project about the global food system. Raj, it's great to have you back again. I was looking at the food lines across the country, pictures of food lines near, not so far from you, in Arlington, Texas. There was a car food line that went on for miles. 4 in 10 people in this country who are on these food lines say they've never been on a food line before. Talk about what this country is facing, and then talk about the world.
Thank you, Amy and Juan. It's great to be back. I think it's important as we think about the horror and the indignity that those clips what we're seeing represent. It's important to remember the context that happened before COVID. Before COVID, hunger rates, food insecurity rates in the United States. And when we say food insecurity, what we're talking about is that worry, that experience, that deep concern, the depression that comes with knowing that your household is not going to have enough food to be able to put on the table for everyone. And so maybe you skip a meal. That food insecurity was bad enough. In the United States, it's been hovering around 13% of households for the past couple of decades. During the Great Recession, it surged to 16%. About 50 million Americans at the height of that recession, and then it gradually sort of fell away to around about 10% last year. About 35 million Americans were struggling with food insecurity, which isn't great. Already, that shows the kinds of systemic betrayal that counts as business as usual in the United States. But what COVID has done is effectively target, and we always talk about COVID as being the great unveiling of the inequalities in America, but the inequalities really strike deep in the food system because 7 out of the 10 worst paying jobs in America are jobs in the food system. And when we have the recession accompanying COVID really striking at the food system and the food service jobs, the people in the front lines who are described as essential workers are also the people who are more likely to be exposed to COVID and also more likely to be in precarious and low wage work. And so what we're seeing, certainly here in Texas, we are seeing these apocalyptic lines. You know, when I volunteer at the food bank, it's desperation is what you see. And the long story here is the continuing kind of war on the American working class. But when you hear about 40% of American households experiencing food insecurity of some kind, that's a new record, and it's a very dark one to be breaking. And as you say, this is particularly targeting. It deeply affects households where there are children, low-income households. 50% of low-income households with children have experienced some sort of decline in income, and we're seeing particularly low-income households of people of color struggling with hunger.
And Raj, sorry, I wanted to ask you, why is it, as you mentioned, that so many of our lowest paying jobs are in the food industry, from those who pick our crops to those who butcher and pack the meats that the public eats to those who serve the food? Why have we gotten to this situation?
Well, Juan, in a word, the answer is colonialism. This settler colony that we find ourselves in, the United States, was founded on a certain kind of agricultural colonialism that involved first the enslavement and occupation and genocide of indigenous people, and then the enslavement of people from Africa. And the long history of the United States is about a long history of the rebellion of people who have been enslaved and whose lands have been colonized. But what we see throughout early and more recent U.S. history is that workers in the food system are disenfranchised, prevented from unionizing, for example, in ways that are deep and systemic. And so if you look, for example, at who the farmers in the United States are, the breakdown is that well over 90% of farmers and farm supervisors are white. And there's a cadence of the way that work in the food system, which was often done by people of color, black people, enslaved people, and also now is done disproportionately by women. All of those figure in the long history of the way in which the United States has militated against workers in those professions from organizing and from asserting their power.
And I wanted to ask you, as we're moving from the Trump administration into the incoming Biden administration, there is discussion that one of the leading contenders for Secretary of Department of Agriculture, which executes food and farm policy in this country, could be Heidi Heitkamp. I'm wondering your concerns about that possible nomination.
Well, as you were saying at the top of the hour when you were listing Biden's current appointees, there's a couple of possible glimmers of hope if you're feeling particularly optimistic. But in general, this is a continuation of the neoliberal run of the Obama era. And of Heidi Heitkamp, I think the most astute analysis comes from my colleague Navina Khanna, who is the co-founder and director of the HEAL Food Alliance. Navina says of Heidi Heitkamp, she's so far right, she was on Trump's list. Within the Democratic Party at the moment, there's a discussion around whether to lean back into the era in which Tom Vilsack was Secretary of Agriculture and essentially sort of continue the long betrayal of farmers that the Democrats have been involved in really, since before NAFTA. Or whether to try a different candidate. The American Federation of Teachers and the Food and Commercial Workers Union, for example, came out recently in support of Marsha Fudge, the congresswoman from Ohio's 11th District, who offers a very different kind of opportunity for the United States Department of Agriculture that isn't about cleaving to the agribusiness monopolies that have bankrolled and supported the USDA for a while, but rather to understand that we need a transformation both in the way food is grown and to support the eating of food. I mean, most of the USDA budget goes to things like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So I think that there is a fight in the Democratic Party at the moment. Heidi Heitkamp, if were she to become Secretary of Agriculture, would signal, I think, the way in which Biden and the Biden administration was really sticking to neoliberal business as usual.
Raj, one of the issues you've raised is who gets the vaccine? We've been having a lot of these discussions. Who gets access to these vaccines that are being developed in the world? And you've made the point that essential workers, not just nurses, doctors, hospital staff, but, for example, food workers and pickers in California, they too should have the first access.
And I agree with me. I think that absolutely the workers on the front line are precisely the workers who are at the front lines of the food system. But I do want to make a point about how this is an international crisis and one that where the hunger in the United States is bad, the hunger outside the United States is worse, and the hunger outside the United States is because of U.S. policy, of U.S. trade policy, of U.S. policy around intellectual property rights, for example. The World Trade Organization. Now, if we are to have anything approaching a just recovery, then let's link these issues and understand that the reason that frontline workers in the United States are often people of color and that there's a long history of undocumented workers being part of the U.S. food system is because of U.S. trade policy. If we are to move out of the COVID era with anything approaching justice, then not only must frontline workers in the United States be vaccinated if and only if it is safe, but also the U.S. needs to stop making the rest of the world hungry through its food policy. That's an addition, of course, to recognizing that the U.S. needs to be lifting the kinds of restrictions it fought for at the World Trade Organization around intellectual property rights so that countries can become powerful enough to be able to not only know the contents of the vaccine, but also the production and processes required to be able to make it effectively and safely. But I think the important point here is to recognize that the U.S. is not an island, that the world suffers not alongside the United States, but because of it. And that if we are interested in moving out of the COVID era, then understanding the frontline workers, whether in meatpacking plants in the United States sending remittances home elsewhere in the global south to other countries in the global south, are all affected by U.S. policy. And that policy must change.
Raj, we want to thank you for being with us, but we're going to be going back to you soon to have this discussion as this problem only worsens in the United States and around the world. Raj Patel, award-winning author, co-host of the Food Politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Among his books, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. And we're going to stay on the world's food system. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn right now to Iowa. It was a betting pool. That's right. As COVID-19 raged through factories and meatpacking plants in the spring, the mega corporation, Tyson, refused to close its largest pork slaughterhouse to protect its workers. While publicly claiming to be implementing all possible safety measures, the managers of the Waterloo plant in Iowa put money on how many workers would get the deadly virus. Soon after, at least 6 people at the plant had died, and more than 1,000 were infected. These horrific allegations were made by the family of meatpacker Isidro Fernandez, who died of COVID-19 April 20th. In a lawsuit, the family claims that, quote, plant manager Tom Hart organized a cash buy-in, winner-take-all betting pool for supervisors and managers to wager how many plant employees would test positive for COVID-19, unquote. Last week, Tyson suspended the managers without pay and hired a law firm to do an independent investigation into the claims to be led by the former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. In a statement, Tyson Foods CEO Dean Banks said, quote, "We are extremely upset about the accusations involving some of the leadership at our Waterloo plant. If these claims are confirmed, we'll take all measures necessary to root out and remove this disturbing behavior from our company," unquote. But worker advocates say the betting pool is just further evidence of mistreatment by Tyson at the Iowa meat plant and its other factories. Tyson produces 20% of America's beef, chicken, and pork. The president of the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, which represents workers at the plant, said, quote, this shocking report of supervisors allegedly taking bets on how many workers would get infected, pressuring sick workers to stay on the job, and failing to enforce basic safety standards should outrage every American. Unquote. This comes as a new study found up to 8% of all U.S. COVID-19 cases came from meatpacking plants. That's more than 300,000 cases. As COVID spikes across the United States, again endangering meat workers, we go to Springdale, Arkansas, home of Tyson Foods headquarters, to speak with Magali Lacolli. She is executive director of Ensidemos, an advocacy group for poultry plant workers. Magali, it's great to have you back again. Thank you for joining us, but very sad circumstances. Talk about what's happened in Iowa. That's at a pork slaughterhouse, and what that means for all meat workers around the country.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. Definitely, this is outrageous and unacceptable. However, this is shocking for the people that don't know how workers are treated every day. When I informed the workers about this lawsuit here, they were not shocking at all. And this is because there exists this in practices among workers. There is a lot of racism, discrimination. A lot of these workers are immigrants, refugees, Black, Asians, and it often so vulnerable that really these companies are treating them like animals. They are treating them as disposal. And this example of the betting pool is just really an example or the sum up of how these workers are going through every day. And so, yes, definitely it's shocking to know that on top of that, the workers were getting sick, they were dying. These companies or these managers were treating these workers just as animals. And just really during the pandemic, we saw the highlighting issues within this industry, that these workers were treated just as disposables, and that these workers were purposely put in risk of getting sick. And this is why even the managers tried to bet, because they knew that it was inevitable that these workers were getting sick, because the company didn't provide even the essential benefits such as PPE or even allowed workers to practice social distancing. And really what we saw during the pandemic and during these months, it was a lot about Tyson pretending that they care for workers. And why I said pretending, because they put a lot of money in PR campaign trying to convince the public that they were doing everything that they could to protect workers. However, they didn't provide basic leave. Workers are used to come to work while sick. And they gave $500 in bonuses with the condition that they didn't have to miss any day of work. And the announcement was made in March when they knew that the cases were growing in their plants and that they knew that workers were going to get sick. So they kind of incentivized workers to continue coming to work. And so when workers told me back in March about these bonuses, And really how the company was forcing them to come to work when they don't have any benefits of basically for anything like that. And so it was a lot of like understanding that this company knew what they were doing, that they knew that they were putting workers at risk of dying, really, because these workers have also carrying a lot of pre-existing conditions or working in the processing plants with high amounts of chemicals, they have developed respiratory problems. So they knew that if the workers were afraid of losing their lives, they have to give them money to make them come to work. And that's what happened. And that's how this all laid out on how they were forcing workers to come sick. And also one thing to mention is like these companies, Tyson and other companies, use this punitive system that it's like if workers missed a day of work because they were sick, they will get a point. If they reach up to 13 points, these workers are going to be fired. So they all the time are afraid of losing their jobs, even for missing work because they were sick. So, yeah, we saw a lot of cases of workers coming in sick, workers being exposed, and also denying workers of the risk of who was in contact with. So there was a lot of like times where workers didn't know how many workers were sick. If the coworker next to them was sick, that information was high to workers. And
I wanted to ask you in terms of the we're in the second and in some places third wave of the COVID pandemic. Have conditions changed at all in any of these plants since back in March, April, or May? And what's your response? Because many of these private employers are seeking to have Congress eliminate any liability on their part for not properly protecting their workers. They want immunity from any possible lawsuits as a result of their negligence in protecting their workers. Your response to that as well?
Yeah, I mean, we saw that the government was really protecting these companies instead of workers. And so right now, workers are terrified for the second wave because the majority of them got sick. And they also have long-term effects of COVID. Many of them are disabled. Like, I know workers who had, like, only 40% of the lung capacity after getting the COVID. And so they are not able to return to work. And Tyson was not paying workers to quarantine. They were not paying workers for being sick. Many workers had to be hospitalized for like three months. And after that, so many of them died. Workers were not compensated whatsoever for those times during being hospitalized. Many of them are facing food insecurity. Many of them are facing, they are going through hardship, not being able to pay medical bills, not being able to pay like the utilities, you know. And so right now the fear is like with the second wave, Tyson has not done anything to protect workers. And in fact, after the outbreaks that we experienced here, the company relaxed its policies about checking the temperature, about asking questions in regards if they were exposed to others or if they travel outside the state or the country. So they have relaxed a lot of the policies. And that's why I said Tyson just was pretending to protect workers, where in fact they didn't do any meaningful changes to continue protecting workers in the long term. So we were demanding paid sick leave. This essential benefit was not granted to workers. It is not. And we are still demanding that these companies provide paid sick leave to workers so workers can assure if they are sick, they stay home without going through this hardship that they are experiencing right now. And so,
we have 10 seconds, Magali.
Yeah. So I think that workers need to that we need to create a set of Bill of Rights to protect workers, essential workers moving forward with fair wages, with health care, with paid sick leave, so that these workers don't go through these situations that they've been going through right now. And so we hope that Tyson really does meaningful changes for workers. It's time to hold them accountable. It's time for consumers to join this fight, to put pressure to these companies, because we are also responsible to make them to do the right thing for these workers.
Well, Magali Lekolli, we want to thank you for being with us, especially on this day before the holidays, perhaps the largest poultry consuming holiday of the year. Magali Lekolli, executive director of Vencedemos, in English that means We Will Win, an advocacy group for poultry plant workers, joining us from Springdale, Arkansas, home to Tyson Foods headquarters. Next up, we look at how this year was the deadliest on record for transgender and gender nonconforming people. Stay with us.
Had enough when I was 14. I ran away so I can foster my dreams, but I didn't have the knowledge. The streets was too much. Mama just taught me I wasn't enough.
You enslaved, so you live it up. Hard days, you never seen them love. I'm not saying I'm the only one. Damn, some days only feel like it.
They say they don't see color, but the blood stain shows the proof. Me up when I was 19. There goes my 20s and there goes my dreams. Put me on the island.
Don't Shoot by Shea Diamond. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Dominique Remy-Fels, Nina Pop, Marilyn Casares, Tony McDade. Just a few of the names of the 37 transgender and gender nonconforming people violently killed in 2020, the deadliest year for trans and gender conforming people on record. This according to a new report from Human Rights Campaign. It's the highest number of deaths since the HRC started recording and reporting this type of violence in 2013. 22 of those who were killed were Black. 7 were Latinx. Human Rights Campaign Foundation President Alfonso David said, quote, "This grim milestone proves we have long known this violence is an epidemic. Each one of the lives we lost was someone ripped from their family, their friends, their community by an act of senseless violence, often driven by bigotry and transphobia and inflamed by the rhetoric of those who oppose our progress," he said. More than 200 trans and gender nonconforming people have lost their lives to violence since 2013. Two-thirds of those killed have been Black women. For more on this devastating study, we go to Atlanta, Georgia, where we're joined by Tori Cooper, Human Rights Campaign Director of Community Engagement for the Transgender Justice Initiative. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Tori. Start off by talking about what you found in this devastating report.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me. There's so many things that we found in this report. We found, as you noted already, that the majority of the deaths have been Black and brown trans women. That's really, really unfortunate. And we're also finding that with Black and brown trans women, often they're being killed by people who they know.
And these numbers, Tori, are likely an underreport of the deadly violence targeting transgender and gender nonconforming people. Could you talk about how police actually are cataloging these and reporting these?
So as a Black trans woman, many of us in the community believe these numbers are terribly low. And in part is because police will tell a story that will talk about a death in a way that's truthful. And by truthful, I mean perhaps the person's legal identification still has an M versus an F. And so they're telling stories truthfully, but they're not telling stories accurately when they discount or what we call dead name people and use them by their birth name rather than their chosen name. When we know that this happens, this is a separate issue, there are legal consequences to this. Certainly there are reporting consequences as well. But we believe that that's one of the things that contributes to terribly low numbers and inaccurate counts. And then in addition to that, families are not always as welcoming and understanding about a person's gender identity. So that certainly plays a part in getting a more accurate count as well.
Tori, if you could talk about that point you first made, you said killed by people they know.
So I use the word relationship. What we have found out is that the majority of the Black and brown trans women who have been killed this year, Black and Latinx, they had some kind of relationship with the person. It may have been a social media person. There was one or two accounts where folks are believed to have been killed by people they went to school with and perhaps had lost contact with over a number of years. So they were in some relationship, that social media. They could have been in an amorous relationship, boyfriend-girl relationship, whatever the relationship. There was some way that they knew each other prior. And as trans women, particularly as Black trans women, if we cannot trust people that we know and that we're in relationship with, then it really takes away all sense of safety and it makes us feel even more vulnerable.
Could you talk about the case of Iyanna Dior, a black trans woman who was brutally beaten by a mob in St. Paul, Minnesota, back in June? How often are these situations even investigated, and are some trans people often afraid of reporting such attacks to the police?
Iyanna Dior's case is unfortunately not as uncommon as we would like to think. And now, I do not know her personally, so I will make sure to say that. But I did reach out to her several times, and we communicated, and through my work at HRC as well. But with Iyanna Dior's case, from my understanding, it was a simple, small tap of a car vehicle. And that escalated into basically a group jumping on her and beating her up inside of a store. Not only was she not protected by the folks who work at the store, but as folks realized her gender identity, more and more folks ganged up on her, really for no reason at all. And what that is it's kind of emblematic of symbolic of how we as trans and gender nonconforming folks, how we're kind of ganged up in society. This young lady appeared to be minding her own business. It was an accident, a small accident that didn't create any significant damage. And yet these folks, not only did they beat her up gang style, they just ganged up on her, but then they videotaped it and played it on social media for others' entertainment. As trans people, we feel that our lives are displayed and our victimization is displayed for other people's entertainment all the time.
Could you talk about the role of the media and how we could have a more positive impact on combating these incidents of violence?
Significant role of the media. Quite often what has happened is the media talks about trans and nonconforming people when we're celebrities or when we're dead. And the truth is, most of us lie in extremes from somewhere in between those two extremes. And so it is important for the media not just to tell stories, as with any other marginalized group, may I add that also. It's important that the media tell our stories in a way that is truthful and accurate. It is important that the media counteract some of the negative imagery around us by telling stories that uplift our community, that provide a more holistic view of who we are. I like to say that add color to the picture of trans and non-binary people. That's really, really important.
Finally, Tori, Sarah McBride is a trans woman who was elected to the Delaware State Legislature, might be the first trans, openly transgender state senator in the United States. She wrote a book about her life experience. Her book is called Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. And it has a foreword by Joe Biden, the new president-elect of the United States. Can you talk about what you want to see this new administration do and what you think the old one, the effect of Trump?
So excited for Sarah. And may I respectfully correct you, she isn't perhaps the first out trans person elected to Congress. She is the first out trans person elected to Congress.
State,
so we're incredibly proud of her. State legislator, thank you. We are very, very proud of her at the Human Rights Campaign and also proud of her in the trans community. So what we expect from her as part of the legislature and also from the Biden-Harris administration is really to hold them accountable. Joe Biden in a recent speech was the first to acknowledge transgender folks. Joe Biden released a statement on Transgender Day of Remembrance, which was November 20th. And so we believe that we now, beginning in January, will now be under the administration that is the most supportive of trans, non-binary, and all other queer folks. What we believe is we're going to hold them accountable so that they not only enact hate crime legislation, new hate crime legislation, but enforce hate crime legislation that's already on the books. We believe that there will now be policies that will be inclusive of trans folks again, being able to join the military. There will be protections in the workplace and in education. We believe that there will be more of a sense of equity when it comes
to
legislation.
We're going to have to leave it there, Tori. Thanks so much, Human Rights Campaign Director of Community Engagement. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.